Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 040.2S1412, certificate number 44568, America's Joan of Arc.
But without these things, I cannot live, and by wanting to take them away from me, or from any human creature, I know that your counsel is of the devil. And that mine is of God. His ways are not your ways. He wills that I go through the fire to his bosom. For I am his child, and you are not fit that I should live among you.
I bet you didn't even know America had a Joan of Arc.
Is this something at the Mall of America?
It's a giant Joan of Arc, like Mayor McCheese statue that children can play in.
Babe the Blue Ox at Wall Drug.
America has, what is America? America's sweetheart. America has a sweetheart. America right. has...
America's, the America's truck.
Yeah.
America's...
What is America's truck?
Well, I think Ford? Chevrolet would tell Chevrolet. You it was, but I might be... more inclined to say it was a Ford.
What if it's Toyota is America's truck now?
Nowadays, right? America's pride, America's cheese.
I'm going to autocomplete. America's cup. There we go.
America's cup, of course. There
we go. America's test kitchen. America has a cup. It has a test kitchen.
Right.
It has a credit union.
America wears its cup for any kind of team sport.
You got to. During the Cold War, we had lead in our cup.
America's lead.
But we had lead in our gas, too. But until recently, I did not know that America had its own Joan of Arc. This was a topic suggested by a listener named Paul. Mm-hmm. Patreon donors of sufficient prestige and generosity can collaborate with us on adding topics to the Omnibus. And by the way, while we're talking about this, in a recent entry... I think the Mobile Bay, the Jubilees of Mobile, Alabama.
Mobile,
mm-hmm. Alabama. I incorrectly said that entry was suggested as a gift for a listener named Emily. And it's a great mystery how the name Emily got in front of me. Because, in fact, there is no Emily.
There is no Emily?
There is no Emily. There is only Sarah.
Oh, Sarah.
Sarah was the one who was being honored with this show about the Jubilees of Mobile.
Sarah with an H or Sarah just without an H?
I don't know. You couldn't tell by the way I said it?
I my sister had a friend named Sarah, so I'm never sure what S-A-R-A sounds like.
Does Sarah shop at Zara?
Sarah was from Iran, Samara. I think.
Ah.
But I also had a girlfriend named Megan. So whenever I see Megan, I go, I hesitate.
I actually knew, I've known Laras and Lauras who are extremely proprietary about their vowel.
Right.
And
yell at you if you get it wrong.
And it's kind of not my problem, Laura
Kristen,
and or Laura.
Kirsten, Kirsten.
At least those you can tell by the spelling.
Well, can you tell the difference between Kirsten and Kirsten?
Oh, there's Kirstens?
Yeah.
We have to know about Kirstens now?
I'm afraid so.
I thought fingernails were made of Kirsten.
No, I grew up in a place where there were a lot of Norwegians, and there I think that's where Kirsten comes from, but I may be wrong.
They just emerge from the from the
they do
from like they're like the rock trolls from Frozen.
Yeah,
they just emerge from the fjords.
Rawr, Kirsten.
Anyway, so we really disappointed our listener by crediting the episode to Emily.
I'm
not
sorry,
Sarah.
I didn't credit it to Emily.
I'm pretty sure it was me. So here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna say Sarah. We're each gonna say Sarah in a few different accents, and we're gonna have Mark Miles go back in and drop it in place of Emily.
Sarah.
Okay. So we're going to go and drop that in. It'll be as if Emily never existed.
Sure. Okay, good.
And of course, nobody's going to listen to these for thousands of years. So.
Right. So they'll have listened to that episode, have heard our awkward, like, robot voice, Sarah. And then they'll listen to this episode later.
And it'll be like behind the music.
Cool.
Very exciting. But when Paul suggested an episode on a person I never heard of, I'm always very interested when it's a topic I've never heard of because, right. You know, that's going to be some amazing new off the beaten track thing.
Yeah, those omnibuses that we've done on like
George Washington,
the personal computer. if we're going to have America's Joan of Arc, I'd sure like there to be an America's Lady Godiva, right? Like,
who would be America's Lady Godiva?
Lady Gaga.
Because her name sounds the same?
Yeah. Is that how it works? I'd like to see her naked on a horse.
Again. It would be some America's Lady Godiva would just be Tawny Katane or some Cinemax era beauty on the hood of America's truck.
I would love to see 80s era Tawny Katane naked on a horse. I'm hoping when I picture America's Joan of Arc, I picture Jane Wiedlin in Bill and Ted's Excellent
Adventure.
Exactly.
That's the whole point. America's Joan of Arc is Jane Wiedlin from the Go-Go's. No, in fact, America's Joan of Arc, it was a name contemporaneously used for a prominent woman of the 19th century. In fact, possibly the most famous American woman of her era and one of the most famous Americans of her era, Anna Elizabeth Dickens, of whom I had never heard.
One of the most famous women of her era.
Probably one of the most famous American celebrities of any kind of her era, and I couldn't pick her out of a lineup.
Who are some other 19th century American women? Katie Stanton.
Exactly. The suffragettes.
Right.
Susan B. Anthony. You've got your Civil War adjacent people like American Red Cross founder Clara Barton.
Right.
Mary Todd Lincoln.
I was going to say Mary Wollstonecraft, but she's English.
Too early and too English. Late 19th century American. Well, I guess you've got other activists, and these names will come up in our story, like activists like Sojourner Truth or Carrie Nation.
What about
then? As now, famous women tend to be associated with forward thinking and progressive social causes.
Sarah. What was I just thinking? I was thinking of Sarah Burton. No,
Sarah Bernhardt.
Sarah Bernhardt was
the actor,
but that was from the 20th century, right? Early 20th, or Sarah Bernhardt?
She's
19th century,
and she will be part of and that scene, American theatrical scene, will be, because that was one of the very few. I mean, face it, there were not a lot of ways for women to become famous in a pretty rigidly patriarchal society.
Abigail Adams would have been famous in the 18th century, but she would have lived into the 19th century, right?
I'm almost certain. Yes. Adams. No, she did. She was president when she was first lady when her husband was president. Right. That's the most, the easiest way to be a famous 19th century woman is to be married to a more famous 19th century man.
Right, wife of a president.
And that was not true of Anna Dickinson, never married. I do find that, you know, it's a conceit of this show and really of all this kind of pop history and podcasting in general that that cool historical things, footnotes, do get forgotten.
Right.
With surprising ease.
Incredibly famous people of their day do not retain their famousness.
Famous fleeting, whatever the Latin for that is.
So what's interesting is we know a lot of musicians, right? Because it's their music that survives them. We know playwrights because their plays survive them. But fame is fleeting if you're famous for something that doesn't get written down.
Yeah, and Anna was famous for doing something very evanescent. She was an orator. She was a rhetorician, a public speaker.
Right.
And no record of that exists because there was no sound or video recording.
And she didn't leave behind her notes.
Right. Unlike women, you mentioned Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. These women are on coins and stamps and statues, but they left behind whole organizations.
Right.
And Anna was not a joiner. They all left behind memoirs, kind of codifying their own life and mythology, you know, that were bestsellers in their time. Anna, as we will see, or Dickinson, I guess we shouldn't use the, it's a little infantilizing to call women by their first names. You know, if you wouldn't call Mark Twain Mark, you should say Dickinson instead of Anna. She left behind no memoir for reasons we will see. It does seem like it's easier for maybe, have you noticed this on Omnibus, that famous women tend to go down the memory hole faster than their male contemporaries?
Well, we talk a lot about woman scientists, and they always seem to be overshadowed by their male patrons, or, you know, by the man who took credit for their work.
Right. Or wouldn't let them into the Royal Society, or, yeah. But even this is a case where, and some of those weren't big names in their time. They were doing what turned out to be groundbreaking work, but nobody knew. This is somebody who everybody had autographed cards of, collector's cards of.
Well, that's why it's called history, Ken.
I think there is something to that.
But there would have been fewer notorious women to choose from.
But maybe that's an argument for why they should be disproportionately popular. If there's fewer to point to, fewer less representation, then you know you're kind of stuck with Mary Anning if you want a paleontologist to make a Kate Winslet lesbian movie out of. You don't have a lot of options.
Rawr.
But this is a case where I think you're right that the people keeping track of who, just informally, of who stays famous and who still gets discussed and taught were largely men and white men for decades.
Who
centuries.
Are the frontier women that we, are there any like?
Calamity Jane.
Yeah, sure.
Annie Oakley.
Annie Oakley.
Sacagawea.
Are we pronouncing it Sacagawea now?
You're not supposed to, right?
Is it Sacagawea?
Well, it's Sacagawea. It's actually Sacagawea is closer to the whatever the tribal pronunciation is, I guess. I don't know. I was corrected by my daughter. Don't say Sacagawea.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, she's so goth.
Is that a quality of goths to say a K instead of a J sound in Indian names?
Seems like it. Seems to me.
They're famous for it.
Does she also say Deutschland?
Yes.
Yes.
That's why Winona Ryder says Beetlejuice instead of Beetlejuice.
It's the Gemini Project, not the Gemini Project.
It's the same kind of, gatekeeping you see today where, you know, nobody really writes about romance novels, for example, you know, even though they're the biggest selling books in any given year.
Right. We talk about Louis L'Amour. But we don't talk about whoever writes those Fabio books.
Those books just kind of vanish because they're thought of as, that's just entertainment for women. You know, it's a way to say that's second class stuff without saying it's second class stuff. And I wonder if there's some effect here, which is why I didn't know who Anna Elizabeth Dickinson was.
It's not just because you have giant gaps in your education.
And I'm a huge misogynist.
Yeah, right.
Between those two things.
All that time that you spend reading DC Comics is time that you could spend learning about the famous women of the 19th
century. I have a lot of information about the All-Star Squadron to impart right now. But sadly, she was never a member. She was, in fact, a Quaker teen, a young Quaker girl from Philadelphia, born in the 1840s.
That's where a lot of the Quakers come from. Philadelphia.
They just grow on. They grow on the vines there.
That's right. It's a font of Quakerdom.
It's like they're like kudzu.
Hmm. The kudzu of Pennsylvania.
Quaker teens creeping all over the Independence Hall, putting up their Quaker graffiti and smoking their clove Quaker cigarettes. Now, what are they made of? Oats.
Oats.
They're cigarettes of oats. Of oats. So wholesome.
That's funny because Hall and Oats. Actually, also from Philadelphia,
Independence Hall and Quaker Oats. That's where they got their name. They were named for the two.
Oh, sure.
They were named for the two most famous icons of their hometown. I don't believe that's true, but she was the Quakers famously were leaders of the abolitionist movement,
right?
Principled Christian thinkers of their time,
progenitors of David Byrne.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think he's a Quaker.
Is that true?
I think he may even still be a practicing Quaker, although he's a little bit pervy for Quaker to be a practicing Quaker.
Do you think like David Byrne and Nixon were ever in the same meeting of the Society of Friends.
Was Nixon a Quaker?
Yeah.
He really does not exhibit Quaker-like qualities.
It's American utopia versus American dystopia.
My mom self-identifies as a Quaker.
You know, you don't have to self-identify. You could get baptized or go to services.
Oh, I see. No, she doesn't want to do that. But but we have Quaker.
She just wants to tell people she has a. Your mom's got a real Quaker vibe, John.
We have Quaker vibes in our.
She does have Quaker vibes.
Am I wrong?
You are not wrong.
She is super duper duper Quaker.
Dickinson's father had actually been a Quaker minister, which would put him at the forefront of a lot of these movements and thoughts.
Although Quaker ministers were notoriously quiet, right? That's the Quaker. I went to a Quaker ceremony in Philadelphia.
People don't talk.
And they don't talk. They just sit there and stare out the window.
You can, if you feel so moved, you can stand and share some kind of witness. But there are analogous meetings in my own tradition. Every month there's some kind of open mic night if you want to stand up and just say something. And there's a lot of pressure in the silence. The silence will always be broken by somebody getting up and being like, "Ah, I couldn't stand the silence anymore. I just want to say, and they'll give a little witness."
At the Quaker meeting that I went to, a guy with a pocket protector stood up and railed against the Bush administration for a few minutes, and then that opened the floodgates.
Oh, so in my experience, Quaker meetings are often, they're very accustomed to the silence.
Yeah. Oh, no, they would never apologize for it.
They'll just happily sit, and it's a moment for meditation.
Yeah.
Quakers are very at home in their own skins, I think.
They have very uncomfortable pews.
And hats.
Yes.
I don't know. They don't all still wear the hats.
They
from
don't.
The,
no, they seem like regular people.
Weird.
You might pass one in the streets. You might. Not even know.
Her father passed away when she was just a baby. I don't think she would have any memory of him. And as a result, you know, there was an expectation that she would have to be a girl with a career to help support her family and until she could possibly marry into greater security. So
which at the time meant teacher or nurse.
Yeah, there weren't a whole lot of options, but you know, somewhat atypically for a girl her age, there was always the thought that you're going to have to do something because your family needs you.
Right. Or chambermaid or whatever. You would go into
domestic
service.
Domestic servant, yeah. She appears to have, from her family, if not her father, from her mother and sister, she appears to have kind of imbibed their social awareness. At the age of 13, or the first public record we really have of her in public life, she wrote a letter to the Liberator, the abolitionist newspaper, which they ran. And I think William Lloyd Garrison, the editor and famed abolitionist, took note of her. This was a time when, as we've alluded to, it was not totally uncommon for women to be in the vanguard of social movements. You know, there were still people who would be scandalized to see a woman standing at a lectern. You know, even that was a little bit of a provocation to old-fashioned thinking.
This was one of the things that started to differentiate, or rather, let me put that another way. The North was always differentiated from the South in the United States. And all of these kind of socially liberal, like women in suffrage, in the suffragette movement, it all would have been, or in the abolitionist movement, that would have been a Northern phenomenon.
Yeah, if you've got a big Scarlett O'Hara hoop skirt, how are you going to get behind a lectern?
That's right.
You'll be so far from the audience.
It would have to be like the mic stand for the singer of Korn. Big H.R. Geiger mic stand.
But the
that one's for the metalheads.
Yeah, they finally got what they wanted out of this episode about suffragette movement.
I'm sorry, millennial metalheads. No metalhead my age would get that reference,
or even want a Korn reference. Yeah, the suffragettes were soldiers in petticoats.
Right.
Dauntless crusaders for women's votes. And, you know, and not just that movement, but other movements as well. Sojourner Truth, famously preaching against the evils of slavery.
Right.
The
precursor to the temperance movement.
Yeah. Later in the 19th, the temperance movement is underway. So eventually you're going to have Carrie Nation chopping up saloons with a hatchet. Because these movements were a little bit out of the mainstream of public thought, it was within the movement, it was acceptable to do things that might seem a little edgy, like have a woman as your keynote speaker,
right,
for example, because you're not interested in conforming to bourgeois Philadelphia, man. Like, you've got bigger fish to fry. Women don't have the vote, or slavery hasn't been abolished. And in particular, the Republican Party of this time was friendly to activist women.
Right.
The newborn anti-slavery Republican Party.
Again, a North versus South.
Exactly. Yeah. Very happy to distinguish itself against the men only, you know, which is funny because women could not vote for a Republican and in fact were, spoilers, still 70 years from the vote.
Right.
Oddly,
it's their emotions that keep them from being good voters, Ken. They have their emotions.
I mean, it is funny today to hear mainstream politicians continue to make this argument that we need to make it hard to vote because if it's easy to vote, all kinds of not so great voters will be voting.
Sure.
You know, like
undesirable voters.
You really got to want it. You know, this is the Mike Lee argument. If you make voting hard, then it's really just the good, skilled voters because they'll be the ones to slalom through all the challenges and actually get to the ballot box.
Sure.
If you make it easier to vote, it could be rookie voters.
Sure. People that are only read one book.
They don't know what they're doing. They might vote for a Democrat. But in 1860, she went to she attended a lecture called Women's Rights and Wrongs being held in some Philadelphia hall. And this was, a common occurrence in American cities was to have this kind of back and forth on the role of women, the future of women, should they get the vote? What does a society look like where they do? What does equality look like? Tumultuous question, you know, in the same way that, you know, you might say that civil rights were in the 60s. Everybody had to have an opinion because it was obviously huge stakes.
Right.
The humanity of the people involved, huge implications of reshaping society.
This would have been the topic of a witty editorial in The Atlantic.
Well, in the 1860s, you've got two of these movements. You've got, you know, you're in your second decade of the women's suffrage movement, and you've got the increasing urgency of abolition, which has been building for decades in the North. So she goes to sit through a lecture on women's rights and wrongs. She's planning on listening to it. And a bustling dictatorial man takes the podium and says that, you know, women are his, you know, his wife and daughter are his special angels, and he'll be damned if they have to get, dragged into the degradation of working and voting. And, you know, with his dying breath, he will stop this terrible movement.
And this enrages her?
Yes. And she gets up and just from the audience just starts yelling at this guy.
Wow, love it.
And this is kind of her superhero origin story,
uh-huh.
Yelling at this doofus.
The audience breaks into spontaneous applause at the point she lands.
Yeah. And everybody, and people know her and say, hey, that was your daughter who shut that guy up at the meeting. And this is a time when there is actually a business, a profession, livelihood to be earned in just regional oratory.
Oh, sure.
Getting up behind a lecture and talking about current events. Her day job is she's a clerk at the U.S. Mint.
Oh, white-collar lettered work.
She's got a steady government job, and there's a mint in Philadelphia. Yeah. So, in the early days of the Civil War, as she starts to get more and more outspoken at some of these kind of open mic nights, she starts criticizing General McClellan and what is now what we would agree to be
right his slow march.
Yeah, his
non-existent march.
You know, she would agree with Lincoln that he was not doing a great job in prosecuting the war, and she was actually fired from the mint for having the unpatriotic position that McClellan was doing a bad job in the campaign.
The president also thought so, but I guess he was keeping his powder dry.
Well, they fired him too eventually.
Oof.
Having written to the Liberator, William Lloyd Garrison has noticed her talent and decides to sponsor her and sees her speaking at these Philadelphia events. And he starts telling her, well, you know, New England is really where it's at. You want to be up in Boston.
Right.
And then people are going to notice.
Charge a nickel. And at the end of the day, you get $500.
It's actually, the money is pretty good. You know, she starts, you know, there's events to talk about the evils of slavery. There's events to talk about the women's equality, and there's places to talk about their overlap or possible tensions between them.
The generals of the army and their prosecution of the war.
Yeah, whether or not Bull Run went well.
So this would have been the editorial. Well, there were newspapers, of course, but this would have been a form of Well, it's when people only had the Bible. It was the only book they had. So, of course, you're going to go. If you're going to go see The Bottle Conjurer, you're going to go see.
I guess the niche is that there's no cable news, right? And what you need, if you want people yelling about the issues you care about, I mean, you could read the op-ed page and yell in your head because you would pick the. You'd pick the paper friendly to your side, or you know, if you're a Democrat, you pick the copperhead paper that's yelling about what a baboon Lincoln is.
Right.
If you're an abolitionist, you pick some fiery northern paper, and I guess that probably fills the same itch as AM radio, you know, or 24-hour cable news. And now you don't have to read it in your head; you can go see some fiery man or woman yelling at a pulpit for an hour.
No thanks. Thanks, but no thanks.
There's always organized religion, John, if I could interest you. So she starts earning $30 for a speech. Then she starts earning $100 for a speech.
That's big money.
She gets called into, I think, New Jersey's state election because she's such a articulate, such an eloquent proponent of the Republican platform.
Oh, so she's giving stump speeches
on behalf of...
Political
candidates, yes, are bringing her in to do their stump speeches.
That's good.
And she can earn $400 for giving political candidates a speech.
Right.
And if you do the math, I mean, this is $400 in the early 1860s. The multiplier
would be...
Sure,
those are James Buchanan dollars.
The multiplier would be something like 30. She's starting to earn five figures.
Wow.
For a speech.
Yeah.
I mean, that's possible to go on a college campus today and get a five-figure check for a speech, but you've got to be...
Five figures?
You've got to be
Ken Jennings.
You've
got to
be Norman Schwarzkopf or something, who is probably not alive. I don't know.
Norman Schwarzkopf is probably not right now...
a five-figure speaker.
Yeah, getting a five-figure speech at the University of Massachusetts.
Or breathing.
Is he dead? Schwarzkopf?
I have no idea.
I haven't heard from him lately.
He hasn't called. He hasn't written.
Colin Powell can probably still go to Texas A&M and get $20,000, don't you think?
Sure. Somebody like that is, you know, ideal. And probably more, actually. I mean, there are...
$50,000?
There are six-figure speakers. If your name is Clinton or Obama or Trump or something, you can...
But you're not speaking to college at that point, right? You're speaking to the Rand Corporation? For $100,000?
Maybe both. I mean, would a college convocation...
Do people get paid for convocations or for graduations?
Yeah, unless they have a book.
I see.
Yeah. You can make a pretty... It's a weird economy where people make more than you would think for an hour's work, you know? It's a weird thing.
That's how politicians end up being worth $10 million.
That's right.
Where you're like, wait a minute, weren't you in public service all these years?
Like Reagan famously did, you know, 10 speeches in Japan right after he got out of office, and he made more than he did in 8 years as president.
Right.
She's really good at outwitting hecklers. She's not just...
Oh, good.
Her impression she gives at the stump is, first of all, she's a novelty act because she's a young woman. She's, you know, she's a teenager still. And she's...
She's a manic pixie dream girl.
They often write about her beauty, the beauty and the talent of the young woman exercised a talismanic effect upon even the rudest. Like all the newspaper accounts of her just cannot stop saying, you know, she's a young girl. And as a middle-aged man, I am very into that. Uh-huh. Like it's the subtext of everything that gets written about her.
Right.
But she's not, you know, she's not notably, she's striking. But you wouldn't say that by either the standards of then or now, she...
She has dark eyes, and dark, you know, dark eyes are their own appeal. Large dark eyes. I mean, looking at her photograph, I will say that she is my type.
Ah, interesting.
So I see how she might, in the spirit of the time, be thought of as a great beauty, because that's the kind of lady I think of.
People go both ways. There's also people writing about her saying, well, although not a classical beauty, there is something striking. You know, the same thing that got written about Joan Crawford, or, you know, any number of people whose appearance is incredibly striking due to, you know,
some
big eyes, yeah, or a wide mouth, or a noble brow, or, you know.
It's a very fine line between, and this is true for men and women, between beauty and hideousness.
Yeah, and often the thing that is most striking about someone is their most unusual or divisive feature. So she often gets heckled, you know, people try to interrupt her speeches by actually saying a fire in a crowded theater.
Was that a joke of the time?
I think it was just an attempt to break up a speech. If somebody's on a roll, you try to sit her down by getting a bunch of rowdies to say fire, fire. And she would just say, yes, there is a fire. By God's grace, we have kindled a fire, which these people by their acts are assisting that will never go out till naught is left of the principles they profess, save ashes. You know, she could just
burn.
She could just do this off the cuff. Yeah. And they would sit down abashed.
Sure. This is it's a kind of intelligence, right?
It's a real quickness.
Yeah.
The ability to just form those sentences is a lifetime of reading and internalizing a kind of voice.
Yeah, bringing it back around to the fire analogy at the end. I mean, just sort of.
But then, yeah, just the mental acuity to keep that up for an hour of quasi improvised speechifying.
She would have been an incredible podcaster.
Boy, I can't think of a nicer compliment. Can you? What an improv comic this lady would have been.
The lowest of all art forms.
She would, and by this time, she is a traveling speaker on pretty much on permanent tour of New England, inveighing against the many crimes against women and slaves. For 8 weeks, she speaks every night.
Whoa.
That
will make one hoarse.
Often for 2 hours with no notes. Yeah,
no microphone.
No, that's the thing. There's no amplification in these halls. So she is just, and maybe that's another reason why women speakers often do well, right? In a time before microphones, they can cut through the buzz of a hall with a higher pitch.
But you would think also just less projection because of smaller diaphragms.
Is that true?
But I think meeting halls then were designed for this kind of speaking, right?
They had good acoustics.
If not good acoustics, then at least resonation. When I think about the performances I've done in this kind of environment over the years, they do have a way where you stand on stage and just speak in a conversational tone and your voice is audible throughout the room.
I mean, that's what the theater required until, you know, just very recent decades when they actually started to mic actors.
Which was the end of theater in my estimation.
It is weird when you can see the little mic on their cheek and
Stop it.
Hey, this is the Lion King. Why does that lion have a mic? Where would that lion even get one of those mics?
A lion wouldn't have a mic. excuse me.
Actually, I hate to mansplain. By 1863, she does a series of talks at the Cooper Institute, I think in New York, and she earns $1,000 for a speech. And that's
one of the highest paid performers of the day.
Really? Like, who else is earning $1,000 for 2 hours in 1863?
I mean, wouldn't make that much in a year.
She's as big as anybody. That's a $33,000, taking inflation into account, that's roughly $33,000 in modern spending.
That's Norman Schwarzkopf levels.
You have to be a pretty
big. That's pre-death Norman Schwarzkopf.
Think how many first Gulf Wars you have to win to earn that much money. And at this point, she starts to take trains out to Chicago and speak there.
Early days of trains.
She can. She's now a national celebrity and not just a regional one anymore. And at this point, the national press, particularly the Democratic, you know, what we'd call the Copperhead press, against the prosecution of the war and for a peaceful end and probably the maintenance of slavery, is really she's an enemy.
She's a national figure, but not big in Atlanta.
Right. Well, in the Confederacy, you know, if they talk about this kind of person at all, it's to point out what an awful freak show the North is.
Right.
But there are plenty of places on the border states and even in northern cities where there's plenty of people who think the war is much ado about nothing.
Right. We'll try and shout her down.
Yeah. And a newspaper says that, these conservative papers always send a columnist who will say something like, they say the woman is a woman is the opposite of a mirror. A mirror will reflect without speaking, but a woman will speak without reflecting.
Oh, and, of course.
You know, they'll just be zinging her on the basis of her sex.
She would have taken them down if they'd said it out loud. But they hide behind their
and I'm sure
squib.
I'm sure in her point of view, any publicity is good publicity because she's suddenly one of the biggest celebrities in America. Autographed photographs of her circulate. This is a new the invention of the photograph means that you can now have photographs in your house, and maybe they're the Grand Canyon, or maybe it's people you know, and there's not a whole lot of household celebrities. She is one of the most popular because of the novelty of her being a 20-year-old woman who is traveling the country at the forefront of these two important movements.
And this would have been a time, I think, where you would go to see a live speaker that you disagreed with. Also.
Sure, you could yell.
Yeah, that's right.
I wonder if there were events where they did the crossfire thing of having, I think they often would, you know, somebody would get up and say, abolition of slavery is a moral imperative. And then you'd have somebody else to get up and be like,
oh,
on the other hand, you gotta get somebody both sidesing slavery.
Who was the William F. Buckley ever?
She's an increasingly powerful political figure. In January of 1964, she is asked by Republican Party leaders to speak in the U.S. Capitol, like speak in the House of Representatives. She is 21 years old.
Boom.
She's speaking to the assembled leaders of their party, and she's speaking critically because, in her view, the Republican Party has betrayed the moral imperative of the radical Republicans. You know, other than the Emancipation Proclamation, you know, what has Lincoln done for you lately? You know, really few guarantees have been put into place for freedmen. Whereas in 1864, the Lincoln administration is openly offering Southern states conditions of amnesty, and here's what it would look like if you lay down your arms.
Right.
And, you know, Lincoln wants to end the war.
Right.
So there's much more rhetoric aimed at white insurrectionists than there is at the slaves who are, you know, at the moral stake here.
Yeah. I mean, that was the period of sort of unholy compromises, right?
So she gets up here and, yeah, exactly. And it's a difficult... you know, difficult for Lincoln to navigate. And she gets up there and just gives this excoriating speech about Lincoln's betrayal of his promise and how more needs to be done. And Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln and Lincoln and his wife are in the crowd.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now, I wonder how much having a young woman give this speech actually slightly defanged it if you were looking for an out, right?
Yeah.
You could sit back and go, hurrump, hurrump, hurrump. And just the fact that it was a novelty speech allowed her to say really
maybe
excoriating things and kind of not...
that a man would not get away with.
Yeah,
because she's shielded by the patriarchal attitude toward women of her day, whereby we must always insist upon their special purity and divinity.
Yeah,
so she can get away with stuff.
Yeah, that it kind of would be like, oh, she's inspired.
But there might be, yeah, like Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
But there might be the opposite effect as well of right. Like, it's a, boy,
truth to power.
It's really salt in the wound that you're hearing this from a 20-year-old woman,
yeah.
Mr. President. And Lincoln was a good sport. He, you know, the crowd wanted him to speak after, and he gave some funny remark via Vice President Hamlin, like, you know, boy, I wouldn't be up to that challenge, or, you know. And then I guess he gave a private audience for Dickinson and
in the White House.
Yes, or maybe in nearby chambers. I mean, this is taking place in the Capitol. So there was some kind of a meeting or a reception. And, you know, she was it's not like she was against Lincoln, but, you know,
right.
in the moment, you know, it's funny to think of a Republican abolitionist party speaker giving an anti-Lincoln speech. You know, that's from our point of view, 200 years, 150 years later, you know, the moment she's mad about the headlines that week.
Right. I mean, all the Twitters about how Joe Biden is
sure.
Selling out the left.
Exactly.
By passing most leftist legislation in 50 years.
It's the equivalent of being angry at people who are not sufficiently against the filibuster or whatever. Yeah.
Speaking on my own behalf, I'm against the filibuster.
Yeah, me too. I've been thinking about it. She'd actually been approached in 1863, the previous year, by Republican leaders, including Samuel Chase, about possibly, it's a document called the Pomeroy Circular, whereby less moderate Republicans were trying to get Lincoln off the ticket.
Oh, for re-election.
For re-election.
During the war.
Yeah, during a war for his own party to oust a sitting president and get somebody in there who's actually going to take slavery seriously.
That has never worked.
Well, Dickinson refuses to come aboard. And this is kind of the beginning of her, although she'll take the money of the political parties that want her to speak at their conventions and events, she is very reluctant to join organizations, put her name on the petitions. I don't know what to attribute it to. Just
political savvy.
Maybe. There's a lot more downside to upside in that sort of thing.
It's like backing Ed Kennedy in 1980.
From the pulpit, you can say anything. Right. And, you've got a lot more freedom in the moment. In the 64 elections, she does end up doing events for Lincoln, mm-hmm. but she's not a huge fan. Generally, she's brought in to pro-Lincoln, pro-Republican events, and then just talks about how awful McClellan is because her old enemy has been nominated as the Democratic candidate.
Right.
And, the Democratic attempt to take back the White House is to nominate the war hero that Lincoln's been feuding with. Hey, John.
Hi, Ken.
Have you been keeping up with the new t-shirt designs?
I think that that our current t-shirt designs are so awesome that I don't want them to expire at the end of the month. I want them to go another month.
They are continuing throughout the entire month in which you are listening to this.
Hooray!
That's for sure. If you haven't looked at the designs, you can go to omnibusproject.com/store where our current t-shirt designs reside. This month, there is a... two omnibus classics. There's a Chick Tract inspired shirt with a fictional omnibus theme. It looks really good. It's kind of drawn in the plausible style of a Chick Tract.
Yes.
And it looks great. And I like this one too. There's the peachy folder, which instead of the normal, what are the normal athletes on a peachy folder? Let me see.
There's the tennis. There's the basketball. There's the football.
There's a batter.
There's the skier.
But this one has,
runners.
You playing rugby.
Right.
This has me. What am I even doing? I'm interviewing. I'm metal detecting for. What do we call this? The floating feet. The Vancouver floating feet.
Oh, the classic 50s sport of metal detecting for feet.
Or maybe I'm interviewing them. I have like a mic. Like I look like a. I look like I'm doing a 50s man on the street interview with the floating feet.
Hmm. Okay. It's cool looking in any case.
And then there's a bear holding a missile. I don't even know. How does that relate to the omnibus? And the famous mascot of our show, Bear Holding Missile.
Mm-hmm.
You love him. You know you love him. These are very cool designs, thanks to our friends at Mediocrity.
They are super cool, and I think they are they really exemplify what Omnibus is all about. And if you're wearing one out in the world and you see someone else coming through the rye wearing an Omnibus t-shirt, you'll know fast friends, perhaps... life partners.
And in fact, it's required to do one of those jumping chest butts.
Oh, yeah.
Even if the pandemic is still going on. I'm sorry.
Even if you can't jump.
Right. Even if you have a half-inch vertical, you still got to try.
Propel yourself at the other person by whatever means of locomotion you choose and collide with them.
If you enjoy Omnibus and you are not wearing Omnibus shirts, you can check that out at omnibusproject.com/store to see what cool things are available.
And going forward, there will be new t-shirt designs there all the time. We kept these over just because they're so great and demand has been so high.
After the war ends, spoilers, the North wins, slavery is abolished. She still has a very lucrative job in public speaking because the Lyceum movement in America blooms from 65 to 75.
Right.
There's a decade where really the leading entertainment in America... is kind of it's similar to some author event you hear on NPR. Everybody's got to go down to the hall and hear whichever luminary is passing through times. So 8 months out of the year, five times a week, she would give a speech, sometimes about the issues related to the Civil War and slavery, although that becomes less and less a concern as the years go by. It's more about the role of women. In particular, she gives a speech called the Jeanne d'Arc speech, a speech about Joan of Arc and who, what would a Joan of Arc look like today? She's already been called, as a young woman giving these militant, sword flashing, eyes blazing speeches, she's already been called America's Joan of Arc by columnists.
This would have been like was she like part of a Chautauqua or were these traveling shows where there were multiple speakers?
Yeah, I don't think the same group would do Philadelphia one night and then Pittsburgh the next. But these speakers were on individual tours setting up solo events.
Now, was this the first time that someone directly connected Joan of Arc with the feminist movement? I mean, Joan of Arc would have been...
There's no way. She would have been such an obvious signifier for Mary Wollstonecraft or anybody.
Right, I see.
My guess is if I look up Mary Wollstonecraft, she will name check Joan of Arc just because, again, there's so little representation for a symbolic national figure like that.
Well, Lady Godiva too. I mean, they were they were ultimately political.
Why do you always go back to the naked one? You know, this is the same way that Mark Twain made his made a fortune. And he went to see Dickinson and he complimented her, although in kind of a backhanded way, he also said, she'll become a right venomous old maid someday.
Yeah, sure. That's a Twainism.
Right. I mean, well, it's any kind of middle-aged white man being like, well, sure, look at this fiery young spitfire. Boy, I can't, don't want to be her husband, LOL. And through all this time, people assumed that she was going to, she was going to marry.
Right. And go into graceful retirement.
And there are letters from some of the biggest names of her day pledging love, including, you know, two different members of Congress, Whitelaw Reid in particular, the editor of the New York Tribune, the most powerful newspaperman in America, had a long, tumultuous relationship with her.
An actual affair, not just one where he was pledging his love in the editorial page.
Letters and meetings. I mean, you're going to have to speculate about you know, what happened when the lights went off, because the letters don't often, but the letters are pretty suggestive.
Were they reciprocated?
It seems like...
Do her letters survive?
Yeah, from both sides of the correspondence, it does seem like she was into these relationships at first and later not.
Right, too smart to get married.
And in fact...
No offense.
Well, and in fact, the most, you know, the most reciprocated relationships appear to be with women.
Right.
I
don't mean right, like, obviously, but...
But you right. are, you do seem very approving of this. And that includes, you know, there's a series of women who are just writing her notes.
Who become her roommates.
Well,
her
yes.
special friends.
Bedfellows with a hyphen, you know, and so we get...
Oh, you mean in the term, in the sense of strange bedfellows, not actual 19th century acknowledgement of lesbianism?
No, I mean sharing a bed and and it's hard to say.
Oh, I see. Well, I guess that would have been socially acceptable differently.
The letters say things like, I see before me now sitting all in a little heap in the bed, laughing at me with her gray, soft gray, with her great soft gray eyes, noble, tender, soul-lit eyes, and tempting me to kiss her sweet mouth and to caress her until... Well, poor little me, poor boofal princess, how can I have thee, queen of my loving heart?
Huh. Well.
Is that ambiguous to you?
Hmm. Rawr.
They're frolicking in bed and caressing and kissing each other.
Yeah, but all of the action verbs are wistful, non-actual, right? They're all like,
yes.
Wouldst thou, and so forth.
But in some cases, these are people who did share a room with her. You know, she would go, you know, as she traveled the country, she would often be rooming with local friends in the movement.
Yeah,
so
right.
it would be somebody who had a wife or a daughter.
An extra bedroom.
Yeah, and she would hop in bed. And, you know, homosocial relations were different back then. It
was a lot of hand-holding.
Yeah, it's not unexpected to see, you know, two men saying things to each other. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean... that they were romantically linked. And
right.
It doesn't
Ishmael
mean
and Queequeg shared a hotel room.
They sure
shared
do.
A bed.
But that doesn't mean they were, you know, harpooning.
Right. Although there's an awful lot of suggestive language in there about naked Queequeg. Not to make everything about Moby Dick.
But her life is just full of these, you know, a series of these relationships with women who just pine after her. Susan B. Anthony.
Really?
In fact. Wrote long letters about how much physical contact she would like and inviting her to her double bed, big enough and good enough to take you in. what worlds of experiences since I last snuggled the wee child in my long arms.
Oh,
Susan B. Anthony called her darling Dicky Dicky, my chickadee, my dear Chicky Dick darling. I mean, when you look at, I mean, there's
my dear Chicky Dick darling. I'm going to start using that in my own letters
to men or women.
My own letters.
It works for both.
Well, as you know, someone who's captivating from the stage can inspire a real passionate, like, love interest.
You feel like they're connecting with you from up there.
Yeah, this has happened to me multiple times in the rock and roll years where watching someone that I know take the stage and put on a captivating performance, I'm like, please marry me. And then they get down off the stage.
And you're like, and you're that's like, Colin Molloy.
Oh, right. There he is again.
So, you know, the bulk of the letters do seem to suggest that some of these relations with women were physical and romantic, and it's not just flowery 19th century language in these feather beds.
But what you're leading up to is that she never married.
She never married.
Huh.
All these relationships with men ended in disappointment for them, whereas the relationships with women seem to have been requited more.
Lifelong.
Yeah. And she remains politically relevant throughout the 1860s. She's invited to an 1866 convention among the Republicans on Reconstruction-related issues, and her speechifying helps convince the party of the importance of black suffrage, which was not a slam dunk after freeing the slaves.
No,
like,
not at all.
But we're not going to let them vote,
I mean,
right?
Reconstruction was not a success, right. Overwhelmingly.
I mean, I don't know if you know this, but mid-19th century America was incredibly racist.
Yes.
Even the people who thought of slavery as a great ill did not think people of a different skin color should be living on their block or working in their workplaces or serving in Congress.
There are all those 40 acres and a mule packages that are still stacked up in some federal warehouse somewhere.
With the Ark of the Covenant. Frederick Douglass later, her speech was so effective that Frederick Douglass later credited Dickinson with essentially writing the text of the 15th Amendment.
Oh, wow.
Guaranteeing black men the right to vote.
Now, why did she not pivot entirely to suffrage as that became the popular movement?
She really seems to avoid women's suffrage conventions. Like, in 1869, Susan B. Anthony finally flirts her into going to a women's rights convention, but this is 20 years after the movement began.
Right.
She just seems to be temperamentally not a joiner.
Right. And that would have been typecasting.
I wonder if it's, you know, there's some degree, I don't know, I don't have a sense of Dickinson personally, but in general, knowing this kind of person, the kind of person who likes to, who can pull this off and who likes to hear their own voice for 2 hours on a stage, maybe
not the one
does not want to be part of a movement.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Because she's the star of the Anna Dickinson Show.
Right.
And if she starts hanging out with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, she's, our daughter's daughters will adore us, but it doesn't necessarily mean that she's in the spotlight.
It's funny how much post-Civil War, race relations probably became a very unpopular topic, even in the North, because there was that sense, as is true also of movies in the 1990s, where we were like, listen, it's a post-racial America, so problem solved, yeah. And let's get this off the table and start just casting Denzel in every movie. It must have been no longer a popular topic because it got down in the weeds. Now we were talking about actual change rather than symbolic change.
And the overlap of that with the women's movement is very tricky.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you feel strongly about women's suffrage, it's kind, even if you're an abolitionist, it's kind of an outrage that black men who your contemporaries all agree are not even, you know, are barely human beings, are voting ahead of you, one of the great ladies of Boston.
Right.
It really is. Well, I mean, it's a slap in the face, or at least it's a reminder of how deeply patriarchal those divisions are.
You could be a suffragette and a racist.
I'm not saying all suffragettes are racist.
No, but it's possible.
I'm not saying the mom in Mary Poppins is racist, although.
Wait a minute.
Could she be? So there's that tricky tension there. And you're right. You know, Reconstruction quickly becomes this crazy quagmire. And there seems to be a sense, even among Republican politicians, that they kind of want it forgotten.
A crazy quagmire by design.
Yeah, you know, she gets asked to speak about Reconstruction issues, and she's just kind of over it. You know, she actually backs Horace Greeley in the, what election would that be, 72 or 68? 68, I think.
This is a Jeopardy question. You'd better have it on hand.
You know, he was the Democratic challenger to Ulysses S. Grant, of whom Dickinson did not think highly. And in fact, there was a breakaway Republican faction that nominated Greeley as well. He was the nominee of both the Democrats and kind of the sensible Republicans who thought that Andrew Johnson's Reconstruction had gone too far and Grant was a divisive figure. So she stumped for Greeley, who, and it kind of in the 90s point of view of, yeah, Denzel's an action hero now. We're fine.
We don't have to refer to him as a black action hero.
We did it. Slavery's been abolished. Right. This is no longer a crucial moral issue. So, you know, her name is still in the papers everywhere for her. You know, she's still an eligible young woman dating all these exciting people. She dates Benjamin Butler, the Union general who famously occupied New Orleans and went on to become governor of Massachusetts. That's a long relationship of flirty letters from him calling her Lizzie in the third person, like her middle name, and pretending there's a person named Lizzie that you should know I'm really into.
That's weird. But also, yeah, I get it.
You don't want to read these Cyrano kind of letters from the terror of New Orleans? Another feminist milestone in the 1870s, she tours the West for the first time, loves Colorado, becomes the first woman to climb Mount Elbert, the highest point in the state. I mean, white woman, I guess we have no way of knowing how many, what kinds of tribal expeditions climbed the 14ers.
Right. Although it seems like something that the Native Americans would have recognized was a pointless activity.
They'd be too bright.
Well, yeah, you get up there and then what? Turn around. It just seems like a specifically European kind of mentality. Like, we got to get to the top of the mountain.
I feel like you're really idealizing the Native Americans
as just too smart to climb.
Yeah, maybe there's a few dopes. Just like we do.
I'm sure it was a dare. Some young brave said to another, like, "Bet you can't get to the top of the mountain before me."
She goes up Pike's Peak on a mule. She enjoys the scandal she creates by actually not riding side saddle.
Sure.
You know, women weren't allowed to put anything between their legs back then.
Let alone a horse.
Including a horse. Yeah, yeah. Maybe the horse is the worst thing. Unfortunately, her career begins to decline. Climbing Pike's Peak is kind of...
That's the peak.
That's the peak.
She reaches the figurative peak and the literal peak.
And the panic of 1873, as you might guess, arrives in 1873, right on schedule.
Right.
And it leads to the decline of the Lyceum circuit. Suddenly, people don't have thousands of dollars to bring in somebody to come in and talk about the urgent call of women today or whatever.
Was there any other development in the theater that would also have made that not as appealing?
Well, the legitimate theater, dramatic theater, is still thriving, and Dickinson decides to pivot to that.
Oh.
Despite the concerns of her family that it's even more unladylike and less appropriate than anything she's done so far at a podium.
She's still a young woman, still barely in her 30s.
Yeah, let's see. She would have been, she's in her 30s. So she's, this is the perfect time for her to become a great stage diva, yes. And... you know, she's already, you know, she's written her first book in 1868 called What Answer, which is kind of a Reconstruction era tragic. It's a kind of a melodrama with an interracial love story as the great Romeo and Juliet tragedy. Apparently it's not any good, but because it's
interracial.
Yeah. There's a character who's passing as white. And then so the wealthy white, let's see, which way does it go? I think a wealthy white banker falls in love with a woman, not realizing that her mom is African American, and you know. So this is all kind of edgy, and even though the book is not good, it gets big reviews from Harriet Beecher Stowe because it's taking on these important issues of the day. So she's thinking, look, I'll just write myself as these great women of history. I'll get out there and be Saint Joan or Anne Boleyn or literary characters. I'll be Jane Eyre or whatever, and it's going to go great. And as again, one of the biggest celebrity, probably the most famous woman in America at the time, she has the clout to do this. She writes a play in which she plays Anne Boleyn, and she performs first in smaller towns, then in Boston. Local critics love her.
Mm.
They say, well, you know, there's kind of an audience consensus that she's not great in the actual emotional.
Not a great actor.
Yeah. But you know, the parts of the play that have just grand speeches, you know, she can do that with her eyes closed and it's all very inspiring.
Right.
But the New York critics never warm to her. No matter where she performs, the New York papers will send somebody to say, boy, this is a bad idea for this, this megalomaniac, thinks she can be an actress.
Right.
And when she plays New York, it's also a disaster. And there does seem to be, when you know, it's impossible to see her performance today. I would guess that she was not some great instinctual actress.
Yeah, just because you're good at Cooper Union doesn't mean you're going to be good up on Broadway.
But all these reviews are very faintly like, you know how, if there's a way to take a great celebrity down a peg, that's the interesting angle for a journalist, right?
Yeah.
She triumphs again is not Dog Bites Man, you know? So, and a lot of these do kind of seem like they're taking a little bit of relish in this uppity young woman who's always been so great and had everything handed to her. Well, this is finally a bridge too far.
Right. She's met her match.
And she makes the mistake of deciding that maybe she announces that one night she's going to give her performance as Anne Boleyn, and then she's going to get up and just rebut her critics. So she does the play, and then the audience has to stay for an hour while she just reads her own reviews and yells at the New York papers.
Yeah, this is like, she's turning into a full-on rock star now.
Yes, and you're starting to see the signs of danger that come with that kind of fame.
Yeah, she should join Oasis.
She writes other scripts where she's a Roman emperor's wife, where she's Jane Eyre, and they're not good. She decides to write a memoir of her stage time, and it sells less than 100 copies.
Oh, ouch. So she's fallen now.
Her star is beginning to dim a little, and she can't resist tangling people. And she seems to be difficult.
Huh.
Maybe she's, this is a side effect of being the most famous person in America.
But also being good at soliloquizing for 2.5 hours, like super inflamed.
That's not somebody you want in a business negotiation.
Yeah, or not somebody you want to get into a personal argument with over who's the little cuddle bunny in the bed.
Yeah, and she could be, again, on the wrong side of expectations about women as well. Right. You know, how dare you, be a good negotiator? That's not what we expect from you.
But even just if she's arguing with Susan B. Anthony, maybe she gets disinvited to some suffragette speeches.
She gets into a business relationship with Fanny Davenport, the great stage diva of her day, mm-hmm. who thinks this is perfect. We'll collaborate. You write some of your great speeches for me. I'll play the Empress whatever. This writes itself. No, she wants it to be a great American story. She wants to, you know, be some woman of the frontier or whatever.
Right, Annie Oakley.
And Dickinson stalls for months. Davenport's like, where's the script? Yeah, it's coming. And finally she says, you know what? America's not working out for me. So here's my idea. Princess of Carthage. Or she tries to sell Davenport on a whole different script. And Davenport comes unglued like, wait, you haven't written a word. You've been... And the whole thing becomes a huge scandal with the two of them fighting in the papers.
Oh, wow.
Girl fight. You know, it's Crystal and Alexis Carrington.
It spills over.
Yeah, so she famously falls out with the great... the other great ego diva of her day, I guess. She decides she's going to pivot to playing male parts.
Oh, I thought you were going to say ad copy, but so now
there's a few steps between her and that.
Now she's going to...
She wants to keep acting. She loves the spotlight, but her new novelty is I'll play a man. Because again, that ties in with her Joan of Arc image.
Right.
Joan,
so she does Woman's Army. Macbeth, or I mean the Scottish King.
She actually does do Shakespeare. Yeah, she plays Hamlet and some French play of more modern vintage 19th century French play.
If you're not a great actor, it's hard to just step into Hamlet.
Yeah, it's not the easiest part in the English language. There was a lot of appeal in these in seeing women play these parts back then. The actresses loved them because they were meatier parts, but also there was some kind of sordid thrill for the audience in seeing an actress in male in seeing a woman in male clothing. You know?
It would still be radical in the theater today. Like, I'm going to see Hamlet, except performed by Meryl Streep.
Yeah, today it would be edgy, but then it's edgy and sexy.
Yeah. Oh.
Because they can wear Hamlet wears a tunic and breeches.
Yeah.
Where else are you going to go to see a famous woman in a tunic and breeches? You know, her elaborate outfits and her other things would have.
In hoops.
They would have hid the human form in the way that everybody back then thought God intended of women.
Right, sure.
And that tour, unfortunately, is a disaster as well, and it loses money. This is a woman who was once making $30,000 of our money a night for a speech. And by the 1880s, she's been supporting her mom and sister. By the 1880s, she is poor.
Oh.
She has said...
She didn't put her money aside.
She didn't. She wasn't a wise John Roderick.
Yeah. Full of IRAs, SEPAR IRAs.
She was a grasshopper, not an ant.
Mm-hmm.
You can name the rock musician. I wouldn't care to speculate.
Oh, so many. But MC Hammer springs to mind.
Exactly. There's, you can be a John Roderick or an MC Hammer. They're the two kinds of music there are. And so she is, and you know, being kind of playing hard to get with all the great men and women of her day has meant that she's now isolated from people who could help her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Benjamin Butler used to call her Lizzie. So she's reduced to, you know, trying to wheedle money out of him in letters. Oh, what I once meant to you, Governor Butler, kind of a thing.
Right.
It's about this time that if you've seen any behind the music about a great celebrity, it's about this time that the accounts of drinking start to seem a little less social.
Sure. They work at a warehouse now.
There's always her with a glass of wine. But now she's got a series of ailments that coincidentally her doctors think she should be drinking heavily for.
Huh. Okay. Right. Those were the medicines, the medicaments.
She starts to, her kidneys are bad. Well, of course, what you need is more beer.
Uh-huh.
She smells of liquor and has to insist that her doctor is forcing her to now bathe in it, which explains the smell. That's a pretty good one.
Well, yeah, but expensive. Bathtub full of liquor. I mean, they don't give it away. She's starting to sound like the bass player of Flock of Seagulls.
Some of the medical problems are real, which, of course, makes her financial situation even more precarious. She now owes doctors a ton of money, and she has no income. In the 1888 campaign, Benjamin Harrison Grover Cleveland, the Republicans try to bring her out of mothballs. You know, remember Anna Elizabeth Dickinson? Well, she loves General Harrison, you know, because he was one of the last Civil War generals, except for Rutherford B. Hayes, the very last kind of, and running very much on the Republican heritage of having successfully won the Civil War.
This is like when Twiggy appears in Blues Brothers.
That's exactly right. Something for Mom and Dad. Here's Anna Elizabeth Dickinson. Wait, is Twiggy in Blues Brothers?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, she's the one that... That meets Elwood at the gas station, and then he stands her up. He stands her up because they're getting chased by the cops.
When you've got Carrie Fisher in your movie, the Twiggy of the late 70s, you do not need the Twiggy of the late 60s.
She's driving a Jaguar. She's got her hair up in a crazy knot.
So she gets trotted out on the campaign trail for Benjamin Harrison, and you know, as has happened in all her other recent business relationships, they pay her the $3,700 and she's like, nope, it was $5,000.
Whoa.
And they say, no, it wasn't. And she says, I'll see you in court.
Oh, dear.
And, you know, and it's tempting to say, well, look, they're manipulating, a relatively powerless woman in an age when powerful men could do that. And maybe there is an element of that. But this does seem to be a pattern in her later life that she is just constantly in a series of lawsuits against people who she thinks have disrespected her.
Yeah, and this is very familiar in show business, that someone who...
It's all these showbiz tropes back almost before there is show business.
They're not famous anymore, but they think they're more famous than they are.
She invented all these...
It's a Sunset Boulevard.
It's a Star is Born or Sunset Boulevard, exactly. Right, and she invented it 100 years earlier. She has a nervous breakdown for which a doctor blames menopause, if you want a reinforcement of the patriarchal
grand old age of 36.
She winds up moving back to Pennsylvania to live with her sister, and kind of becomes an eccentric crank in the little village of West Pittston.
Her sister, who saved her money, so it's like the end of the jerk.
And it does not go well in her sister's house. It's kind of it's not whatever happened to Baby Jane, but it is like your crazy aunt is now upstairs. And she gets increasingly paranoid. She gets a telegram from her lawyer in New York saying, hey, you need to come on such and such a date for your lawsuit against the Republican Party. And she's like, I don't believe this at all. My enemies have conspired against me. Why are they trying to draw me to New York?
Oh, dear.
What does this mean? She refuses to show. It leads to yet another postponement of her trial. She decides that her sister is starting to tamper with her letters. She starts to see suspicious crystals at the bottom of her coffee and starts to wonder if they are poisoning her.
So she Howard Hughes's it.
She starts to really Howard. At some point, there's an incident with sewing shears in which either accidentally or on purpose, her sister gets her finger cut by Anna Dickinson.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that she used pinking shears on the edge of her dress.
She was pinking shears on the edge of her sister.
Oh, yikes.
And finally, on February 23rd, 1891, her sister has had enough, and a group of seven local doctors burst into the room where Anna has locked herself for several weeks, and they...
institutionalized her.
Yes, she is committed to a mental asylum. And, you know, this only increases the number of legal battles that she's facing. You know, she spends a number of weeks in an asylum and is then released to the Interpines, which is the home of a doctor for kind of outpatient, halfway house kind of stuff. And they tend to agree, yeah, she's not a danger to herself or others, but...
she hasn't had a complete break.
But she is definitely kind of a nutty old person spinning conspiracy theories.
I mean, you never know about bipolar, for instance. Like,
yes,
you know, how you can be a very inspired, exceptional young person who then over time loses control of the reins of a mental illness that wouldn't have been, no one would have known at the time.
And substances appear to be involved here, which is the kind of thing that can accelerate that. Or, you know, it could also just be, it could have started as self-medication for those problems or demons, and then it just...
yeah,
you know, accelerates the timeline.
This is the patent medicine era when she could have been taking all kinds of crazy narcotics.
So in addition to her legal battle against the Republican National Committee, she's now suing all the doctors who locked her up. She's suing the press for libel for anybody who wrote about it. It kind of is much ado about nothing. A lot of these end with hung juries. But... you know, it wasn't just a crazy old lady's crusade. She ended up, in the two trials over her commitment, she persuaded 20 of the 24 jurors.
Oh.
You know, both juries were hung, but, you know, in both cases, she made a persuasive case.
24 jurors?
Well, it was two different trials after the first hung jury.
I see.
So, that would be, you know, 10 and 2 each time, maybe.
Yeah.
And on her libel cases, she went 2 for 3. She won the majority of them. But it's a sad period for her. She's still continuing to write long, rambling letters to anybody she knew from back in the day who's still in the public eye. She makes a deal to write a book, but then her publisher is upset. Her publisher is like, yeah, write about the great days of the movement. Write about speaking to Congress. And all she wants to do is settle scores. She just wants a book about, and then Whitelaw Reid said, and then, you know, that he was going to take care of me, but then did you know what the Tribune printed? You know,
right.
So she has really gone down, you know, kind of her own internal rabbit hole. And
get off of Twitter. That's what I would say to her.
Get off Twitter. So, you know, she never gets a publishable manuscript. And it gets to the point where in 1910, she clips her own death notice from the paper. You know, somebody's like, hey, whatever, it's Walter Scott's personality parade. Hey, whatever happened to Anne Elizabeth Dickinson? You remember America's Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
And the editor says, sadly, she is dead.
Oh, really? So it's an accident, but it fulfills some conspiratorial prophecy for her.
I think I don't know if she clips it. Maybe she just enjoys the irony of having outlived all her naysayers.
Right.
But yeah, she puts that in her scrapbook, just like maybe Norman Schwarzkopf when he hears this episode, if in fact he's alive, because who knows, really are you going to Google it?
I'm going to figure out.
You don't want it to be,
No, you're right. I'll leave it.
Schrodinger's general.
No, I'll leave it.
There is kind of a nice, footnote to the end of her life. One of which is she lives until the Great Depression.
She lives until the 30s.
She lives into the early 1930s.
Wow. But the entire time... like an impoverished, like, footnote?
Well, here's what happens. She's living in this doctor's house called Interpines, and the kindly groundskeeper and his wife befriend her. And when she's released, you know, she has no place to go. Benjamin Butler is not going to send her money again. Whitelaw Reid is tired of her letters.
Right.
Susan B. Anthony's not taking her calls or answering texts. Susan B. Anthony's leaves you on read. You know that's...
right.
You know you're in bad news.
Susan B. Anthony, of course, not being alive in the 1930s.
No, this all happened earlier upon her release from the
for Interpines.
From the insane asylum in the early 1890s.
So she moves into the humble shack of the woodcutter?
The Ackleys, this nice couple, has a cottage in town, and they've got a spare bedroom. And George and Sally Ackley are you know, admirers. And boy, she was the most famous woman in America.
Right.
We can put up with her cranky outbursts.
Right. It's like having Dick Cavett come live with you.
Wouldn't that be the dream?
I spent a week in a hotel with Dick Cavett. I'm not sure that would be the dream.
I'm sure he's doing. What's an example of somebody who, if they were like Ken, you know, Sir Ian McKellen's in trouble. He's blown all his money on unwise investments. He put it all in GameStop.
I don't think Ian McKellen was ever the most famous person in America, though. What is who was the most? It's like Evel Knievel coming to live with you.
Okay, Lee Majors is looking for a place to stay.
Right, Burt Reynolds.
In a heartbeat, you would put Lee Majors in your guest room,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, I would.
And that's what the Ackleys do. And she lives as kind of a, you know, it would be tempting, maybe this is, again, the patriarchal voice, but it's tempting to say she lives as a reclusive old lady in this New England town well into the early 1930s. But, you know, it's probably more accurate to say she's just an old lady and she doesn't go out much.
Right. She gave no speeches about World War I or the Roaring Twenties or the Great Depression.
She did not. She lived to see women get the vote, which many of her contemporaries did not.
That's nice.
She never actually voted. I guess by the time she was able, she was burned out on the whole thing.
Didn't care.
Never.
Didn't vote for Hoover.
Ironically, never voted. but what's interesting is that later, later historians checking in on, you know, kind of rediscovering Anna Dickinson in the early 20th century went to see the Ackleys. The family that she lived with. And it became very clear from interviewing them that George and Sally Ackley kept their cordial relationship. But in fact, Anna Dickinson and Sally Ackley were a very happy couple. Or throuple, I don't want to speculate.
Oh.
But that she found...
Mr. Ackley was a beard.
Mr. Ackley was kind
of
a... Or the
reverse beard.
Was kind of a... Yeah. You know, I don't want to speculate, but that she and Sally Ackley had a happy, partnered relationship.
Oh, isn't that nice?
And I think Sally outlived George Ackley. So, you know, after he died, they didn't have to worry about...
His reputation, his sensitivities.
Or delicate feelings.
Yeah.
And she got the, you know, even though she never married, she finally...
Got domesticity.
In her happy old age, or as happy as she could be after... A meteoric rise to fame followed by just a kind of a sad and very American decline.
Right. What a touching denouement.
There should be a movie. If Mary Anning gets a movie by pretending she's lesbian Kate Winslet, you know, this seems like it's tailor made for, it's got three acts.
Right. Who would play her?
Winona Ryder.
Yes, Winona Ryder, except, yeah, right, Winona
and then,
Ryder.
And then digital goth 80s Winona Ryder as young. Do you de-age one person or do you suddenly switch switch it up when she's coming down Pike's Peak?
Midstream,
Which
is more unsettling?
Who would it be? Anya Taylor-Joy goes up Pike's Peak in a mule and Winona Ryder comes down.
I don't think that digital technology is quite up to snuff enough to turn her into a Princess Leia, a young Princess Leia from behind.
Hope.
Because she's going to have to give like long impassioned speeches in the first act of the film.
We need to wait. We need to wait for technology to catch up and give us Anna Elizabeth Digitson.
And right. And wait for Winona to age enough that she could plausibly be a crazy biddy.
What you need to do is start shooting it now with a young actress. And
oh, there just, you go.
And make it for 50 years. Do it the Linklater way.
And that concludes America's Joan of Arc, entry 040.2S1412, certificate number 44568, in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that you were famous, internationally famous or nationally famous, in your young years as a zygote, and now are relegated to living with the gardener's wife... you can communicate with Ken on Twitter and Instagram, at Ken Jennings. You can email us both, and Ken might read your email to me, at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can support the show at patreon.com/omnibusproject. I also have a Patreon under my name. You can go find other futurelings who resemble you in every way, as long as you are a librarian or a mycologist, under the futurelings heading on all available places for people to discourse with one another, including shortwave radio. And you can mail us things at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Now, all that ripping sound you're hearing is Ken opening our mail. What do you got over there, Ken?
You got a gift.
I did.
Yes, from our friend John Kay out of Rochester, who is welcoming us to the Vespa Motorsport family.
Oh, sweet nectar.
And it's a housewarming gift.
John Kay.
He sent you a Vespa.
Oh, isn't that sweet? It's a little die-cast model Vespa, and it's not even that little. It's the size of not quite a Barbie Vespa. It's like a G.I. Joe Vespa.
Is this some Vespa reseller, or is this actually, does Vespa still exist as a corporate entity?
Oh, Vespa does. I mean, Vespa is now making new, what we call plastic twist and goes, but this is a not quite. It's a P200E, which is one of the ones that I owned, and I don't know. I don't think they still make the P200, but they do in India. They still are making these in India under the Stella brand. How cool. I love this Vespa. It's got, this Vespa has some, like, some chromed, like, bumpers, which make it not quite mod, but mod-ish.
Let me be the first to welcome you, John, to the Vespa Motorsport family.
Thank you.
You've taken your first step into a wider world.
Vespa Motorsports.
We also received from Sally in a it's an anti-static mailer. Do not bend or fold and avoid exposure to all magnetic fields. Oh. Sally, what are you sending us that the magnetism could interfere with?
How many Gauss is this protecting us from?
I hope we degaussed the mail as usual. Oh, look, Sally also sent us Lego representations of ourselves.
Oh.
I have to say, mine is a dead ringer, but you are just a little man with a mustache now.
Oh. Well, you know, I've noticed when I appear in photographs with a mustache that a lot of futurelings object. They say, wait. I do not accept John with a mustache. John with a beard is the canonical John. John with a mustache is just some
anti-pope?
Yeah, some anti-pope.
Some false god?
This does look very much like you, and I look like...
It's kind of a little pencil mustache, like you look like Timothy Dalton in The Rocketeer or something.
Yeah, okay, well, I mean, this is one of me. That's the go-to-Hawaii me, right? I always shave my beard so that I can wear snorkels more comfortably when I go to Hawaii.
The reason why Sally made us these minifigures is because her boys are now in their late 20s, early 30s, and now they've got a room full of Legos that they don't know what to do with.
Oh. Thank you. That same problem.
I do.
You know what to do with them.
Well, my kids are aging out of the Legos, and I don't even know what to do with them. I've got...
Give them to me. I've got a little kid who loves Legos.
Maybe we'll give them all away one Lego at a time on the show.
I've told you this 500 times, and you're like, yeah, I'm not quite ready to get rid of my Legos.
Well, I don't know if...
Go down and look at them.
I don't know. What's my project? What am I going to build out of Lego?
You already have a Saturn V. Why don't you build, Castle Wolfenstein?
How about a life-size version of us doing a podcast?
Oh, I like that. Including the table. So it's got to be, it will weigh like 8,000 pounds.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.